This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
One thing we don't want to follow the rest of the world on is a convention that is set to be ratified by the UN this month. Now, this has already been approved by a committee of the UN, put forward by Russia and China, and you'd think that would set alarm bells off, but the majority of the UN is supporting this convention on cybercrime.
Earlier this month, the government announced that Canada signed the United Nations Convention Against Cybercrime, with ministers Anita Anand, Gary Andesangri, and Sean Fraser touting the treaty's child protection provisions and human rights safeguards, which were described as, I'll quote, among the strongest found in an international criminal justice treaty, closed quote. The announcement, released in mid-July with few paying attention, left out much of the story. The reality is the convention is not primarily a cybercrime treaty at all, but rather a sweeping cross-border surveillance and electronic evidence-sharing agreement that Canada originally opposed, that leading human rights groups and 20 Canadian organizations and experts urged the government to reject, and that key allies have thus far declined to sign. So the signing came as a surprise, sparking many questions about the treaty, its risks, and what changed over the past 9 months between Canada no-showing the signing in Vietnam and this month's reversal. To help answer those questions, there is no one better than Kate Robertson, a senior research associate at the Citizen Lab, who has been vocal on the convention since negotiations began years ago. She joins me on the podcast to discuss her concerns and how the convention fits within the broader political and policing frameworks. Kate, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great that you've come back. So on July 16th, just about a week or so since we record this podcast, Canada quietly signed the UN Convention Against Cybercrime, a treaty that it originally opposed at the UN. In fact, it skipped the signing ceremony that was held in Hanoi, Vietnam, just last October, and suddenly signs in the middle of the summer with no real explanation, certainly no fanfare. You've been tracking this treaty since the negotiations. Can you take us back, for those that haven't heard of this, take us back to the origins? You know, how did we get from there to here?
I'm going to zoom out even a little bit further, because if you're, you know, even half paying attention, you might find yourself a bit confused on treaty making when it comes to surveillance and cross-border operations in Canada and around the world. You know, I was on this podcast, in fact, I think it was last fall, talking about two other, you know, regional or bilateral frameworks on information sharing with foreign states. And now we're talking about something different altogether coming from the UN. And if it all seems confusing, it's really because it is. All of these frameworks are developing for different reasons in siloed, asynchronous, but in overlapping ways, subject matter wise. And they really don't leave us with a coherent system of cooperation, but really a maze of reforms that, I don't envy any government official tasked with operationalizing them. Collectively, that confusion is bad for cooperation. It makes things clunky and inefficient. It also increases the risk of things going very wrong with very bad results. And so when we're talking about the UN Cyber Crime Convention, we're talking about something that has quite a long history at the United Nations. What makes matters even more confusing, perhaps, is that this isn't the first cybercrime convention. There's a Budapest convention that came into force in 2004. And if you look at the text, they're eerily similar, but not the same. So really, you know, for the average observer, what's going on here? And so what's really going on is that for really decades, Russia has been engaged in efforts to use the UN as a forum for pushing its vision for state control on cyberspace. That vision includes a state-controlled internet that has a state that determines what the population sees, and the information environment is subject to both control and surveillance, where the state views opinions or expression to be a threat to that state or public order, it's subject to criminalization. Russia has pushed a narrative for quite some time that the Budapest Convention was flawed and Western-centric, and so has tried to replace it with this. And that has sort of led us to this strange situation where Russia, which has been described as the single biggest source of cybercrime, is leading a multi-decade push for a second cybercrime treaty at the UN. It's a forum that has understood to be a safe haven for cyber criminals to the extent that they don't operate and direct their activities towards Russian infrastructure. And so I think it's really a red herring to think of this instrument as being about cybercrime. What we're really talking about, tough on crime, but crime that we don't normally think about when we're talking about ransomware, but the criminalization of counter-state expressions of political opinions. And so for a long time, countries like the United States and Canada and the EU used diplomatic efforts to prevent negotiations from happening at the UN. And when a bare majority in 2019 ultimately pushed negotiations forward, a diplomatic struggle has ensued for years since then. And the reflection that we have now in the form of a final text, it really reflects a deep fault line in the global community about the role of human rights in the digital age.
Certainly hearing it described that way as a Russia-inspired treaty that in many respects has very little to do with cybercrime, or at least an alternative to what we find being used in Europe and North America, is troubling on its own. But I think it's worth drilling down a little bit just how far this treaty can extend beyond what people would typically think of when they think of, you know, hacking, ransomware, online fraud. In fact, that's really been one of the central criticisms I know of this treaty, where if you're dealing with procedural powers applied to electronic evidence of any crime, cooperation can then extend to a whole range of different things. Can you talk a little bit about what the treaty actually requires and why there are real concerns about the scope that can be so broad?
Mm-hmm. Right. So the whole text of the treaty reflects this tug of war between what we think of as true cybercrime, actors with criminal intent, you know, engaging in theft, fraud, ransomware. And I think that tension is throughout the treaty. It's even in the title of the treaty itself, where if you look at it now online, it's a composite of two titles that there was a back and forth in negotiations. Is it going to be called a Convention on Cybercrime or an instrument for, you know, crimes committed by means of information and communications technology, which is, you know, very, very broad. And so one part of the treaty facially defines cybercrime so that as to, in theory, it's supposed to harmonize cybercrime laws across borders. You have another chapter that mandates surveillance capabilities in respect of those types of crimes. Chapter 5 is a cooperation and mutual assistance framework, and that's where it blows it open to electronic evidence of any domestic criminal offense, so long as it's punishable by at least a maximum of 4 years prison. But that's not a dual criminality requirement. That's just according to the law of any requesting state. And we have a protocol underway. It's really been underway even before the treaty was finished to expand the list of what constitutes a cybercrime. And that is really a function of the goal that's been there from the get-go to have a very broad list of any crime that incidentally involves the use of ICTs. The Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights and other human rights groups express concern about Article 4 of the Convention, which open-endedly will apply it to any future protocol that states agree to, which defines crime that involve the use of a computer. So I think that the concern here is that it's, again, using cybercrime as a political prop. Not even a year after the treaty is opened for signature, we already know that's a problem. There's a growing list of countries where cybercrime laws have been abused to bring prosecution and imprisonment to journalists reporting on state corruption, for example. Unsurprisingly, among states that are already signatories of the treaty, and a wave of new cybercrime laws that are coming forward or recently passed, which go far beyond core cybercrime offenses and reach to content-based prohibitions.
Okay, so really broad in that way. I mean, the irony when you talk about how it can extend this way is that the government's announcement, the Canadian government's announcement, touted the human rights safeguard as amongst the strongest found in an international criminal justice treaty. Now, I know you've described the safeguards very differently, and you're certainly not alone in that regard. During the final negotiations, many of the countries, including Russia, China, India, voted to strip out a provision limiting cooperation where an investigation is really aimed at punishing someone for their political opinions. You talk a bit about, and in some ways you already have, but just to really, I guess, expand on it, what that episode tells us about how many fear that some of those countries and others might seek to use this treaty.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the temptation by state actors to sort of describe the safeguards that are there in a glass half full way, but I don't understand that in the context of a sign-on statement, which doesn't express any concern about how states will implement this, given how much we know about what the states, what certain camp of states, what their true intent is in pushing this treaty forward. And it's even hard to square that statement against what we know the Canadian government said during negotiations, which was in pointing to the cooperation framework. They said that it applies to a scope of conduct that is, quote, subject to the whims of what a government may legislate as a serious crime at any time. This is a concerning potential outcome, and we can find no other UN criminal law treaty with such a broad and ambiguous parameters. And that's really hasn't changed in terms of the scope of Chapter 5. And so I think that when many describe how weak the safeguards are, they're very much bringing that criticism in contrast to what we know is the very significant danger as to how states want to implement this treaty and what its political and normative purpose will be in terms of the fight for a free internet. When you look at the content of safeguards in contrast to that threat, what you really see is how even what's there have been softened into the form of interpretive clauses rather than mandatory obligations. They're often filtered where they're there through the language of what states include already through domestic law, when we know that the domestic law, many of these states, is already in violation of international human rights standards. And we know that the robust state sovereignty clause, in contrast, has already been pointing to as an interpretive option to give states, more control over what they do decide to put into their domestic law requirements. And so this is, I think, overall, like, you can get into the weeds for quite a long time about how many of the different recommendations of, for example, the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights at the UN had said what we need to fix, and those measures were not added, unfortunately.
Yeah. No. So they spoke out. There are a lot of other people have been spoke out throughout the negotiation process in particular, and you were certainly really prominent among them. I wanted to highlight at least a couple of your efforts that you were part of. Back in December 2024, you joined with nearly two dozen Canadian organizations and experts in a letter that urged the government not to sign. There was a particular focus on transnational repression. You know, how does this convention cut against the safeguards Canada's built into its existing framework for cooperating with foreign governments? In other words, you know, you talked about sort of the difference between what we see happening domestically and what this treaty envisions. How can we contextualize that a little bit with what we've seen, what we've done here in Canada, and how this feels a bit offside to what the Canadian governments have long been trying to do?
Well, I was surprised to see in Canada's statement this month the notion that they're doing so with civil society support. And the only thing I've seen in Canada said about this is the letter you reference, which very much had recommended and urged, in fact, the government not to sign on. It spoke to the human rights and transnational repression concerns that organizations have been speaking about for years at the global level. It also highlights how, you know, while some of Canada's allies we've seen have essentially chosen to hold their nose and sign for diplomatic purposes, Canada is differently situated. They're not, you know, we're not a signatory of Convention 108 Plus, which is an international treaty on data protection. We haven't implemented some of the robust data protection rights and institutional safeguards that a modernized Privacy Act would hopefully bring enforcement powers for the Privacy Commissioner. These are gaps. We know that the government is in dire need of extradition law reform. And a 2022 parliamentary study had pointed to how we need to withdraw from treaties with partners that seriously contravene international human rights standards. We're going in the complete opposite direction of that. And in the recent study of Bill C-22 in the House of Commons, the government ignored calls that were made to reform Canada's mutual assistance framework to add default safeguards like dual criminality, built-in refusals to assist in politically motivated or discriminatory investigations. These safeguards are not present in Canada's system, which means we're uniquely vulnerable, despite the fact that, you know, millions of people in Canada are either born in another country or have family members abroad. This is not an area we can afford to take risks on.
Yeah. Okay. No, I want to come back to the Bill C-22 and lawful access in particular in just a bit. Before we do that, you also have a Lawfare piece, and I'll put links, obviously, both to the joint letter and to your Lawfare piece in the show notes. It argued that the treaty is poised to become a vehicle for complicity in the global mercenary spyware trade at the very moment that we're seeing countries around the world try to combat spyware abuse. I mean, it just seems such a crazy disconnect here. How does a treaty that's nominally about fighting cybercrime end up facilitating spyware?
Right. And it's a good question. And it's really digs into a subset of really the broader issues here. But I think it's a really important one. When we're talking about mercenary spyware, of course, we're talking about spyware companies that sell to governments around the world. Some of the most powerful intrusion tools, infecting phones with remote access intrusion capabilities, and give the operators total access to the phone in a really secretive manner, which thwarts accountability and is just unfortunately too tempting, we've seen, to not be abused by governments around the world. And the international community's understanding of the threat of this industry has unfolded in more or less the same time frame that these UN negotiations have been going on, negotiations since 2019. The murder of US-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and who is a critic of the Saudi regime, for example, it happened in late 2018. And I reference this, of course, in the context of mercenary spyware because of Citizen Lab research and other investigative reporting that described how NSO Group's Pegasus had been infected on Mr. Khashoggi's inner circle in the time frame of his killing. And, you know, our research has documented spyware abuses by both authoritarian and democratic governments around the world, targeting journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, family members, opposition politicians, you name it. And so in 2023, we had Canada sign on to a joint statement with other countries recognizing the threat of this industry to both human rights and national security. The same year, you had GCHQ cyber industry warning about how this industry itself is fueling the ransomware and malware as a service ecosystem in cybercrime itself. And so why do I raise this in the context of the convention? Well, because the drafters did not include combating spyware in its text, the failure to do so means the treaty itself is going to act as a driver of uptake of this ecosystem. States that point to the surveillance and intercept capability obligations can weaponize those as cover to justify their purchase of this type of tool. And the cooperation framework in Chapter 5, one of its central criticism is its legalization of informal arrangements and joint investigation teams that are very capable now with international law blessing to go forum shopping and outsource the use of controversial methods to jurisdictions with lax controls. And data obtained from spyware can essentially be laundered through data sharing channels that are highly secretive and legalized under this treaty. And so it's an extremely permissive operating environment, and it's something that you know, without any built-in safeguards, is still deemed under Article 47 to allow the treaty itself to be a basis for such cooperation. That would include agreements like between, you know, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who we know signed a cooperation framework in 2013. And the UAE was an agency that had put Pegasus spyware on the phone of Mr. Khashoggi's wife in the months before his murder. And so, you know, cooperation networks of this kind will receive official status. And we've seen that's not just a spyware problem. That's a matter of transnational repression and repression generally worldwide.
Okay. You know, somewhat related to the spyware issue is security vulnerability, security research more broadly. There was over 120 security researchers who also came out against this treaty, warning about its chill to security research on a global scale. And some of their concerns, I know, focus on the powers to compel disclosure of information about security safeguards and vulnerabilities. You know, I guess, again, it begs basically the same question. How does a treaty about cybercrime put security research itself at risk?
Right. Well, so, I mean, even building on the same topic of spyware itself and that statement by the GCHQ cyber agency about how this technology is fueling ransomware itself. You know, if it were not for government purchasing of these contracts, the permissive market would be a black market and it would be forced underground and the economics of their funding structure would have to fundamentally shift. And so we're getting crime so that we can supposedly fight crime, which, aside from being very ironic, is not at all a good thing. The central criticisms on this topic have also focused on Article 28, sub 4 of the convention, which has been widely criticized by industry, civil society, human rights experts for opening the door to using powers to force service providers to disclose information about security safeguards in their products, disclosing encryption protocol vulnerabilities or passwords. And it's also an issue of criminalizing security research itself, given how broad the cybercrime offenses are. It repeats really well-known problems with cybercrime policy that has existed before this treaty, which is where we've seen good faith, whistleblowing, and security research come under threat of prosecution or actual prosecution, even for basic activity like violating a company's terms of use. It's very chilling towards good faith AI research or social media platform accountability research. And I think what's particularly concerning here is the breadth of this convention's jurisdiction clause, which explicitly opens the door to states pursuing extraterritorial offenses against individuals outside their borders, which means security researchers will face an increased risk of cross-border investigations for their work and even extradition proceedings, which is highly detrimental to cybersecurity research on a global scale.
Yeah, no, it clearly would be. Let's turn to the politics of this for just a sec. Canada's allies are really split on this. There are some, to be sure, that have signed this treaty, the UK, France, Germany, Australia, and the EU. But there are many that have not, and Canada was, of course, one of them up until just a week or so ago. The United States hasn't signed, Japan, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Nordic countries also stayed away. You know, what do you make of that split? And, you know, is there an argument to be made because Canada and many of those countries were against this at its inception, where they saw this for what it was, an attempt by Russia and China to create an alternative to what was already in place. But they made a decision to be inside the tent and try to influence it. So, you know, what do you make of the split? And then what do you make, I guess, more broadly of the strategy that countries that were deeply concerned even from the very start thought that it was better to be part of this than to simply stay away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you think about what state positions are now on the treaty, I think you really do have to go back and understand it in the context of the origins of the convention, its negotiations, where you really have this normative battle going on about cyber governance generally at the UN. And so I referenced this name of the sort of push and pull about even how to title this. You could You could even name the treaty states doing what they can to stop Russia from turning the UN into a runaway train on repressive cyber governance. This is a political or normative symbolic fight, I think much more so than being about cybercrime, because as I've spoken of, and as many states have pointed to, we already have a very widely adopted cybercrime convention available. And so it's really just to convey how much realpolitik is going on behind the scenes. And so you do see different responses. I think some states that Canada would consider as an ally are sort of squinting at the safeguards and calling them good enough and hopeful that, you know, we can, you know, somehow pat ourselves on the back that we're going to do something symbolic on cybercrime, even if that's what it amounts to. I think you also have talking points here from, you know, representatives in the EU. I've heard about how this will help combat CSAM, for example, or child sexual abuse material, which, you know, this is that arena is really probably the most universally and comprehensively covered fields in international crime instruments. So you have these talking points, even though the suggestion that there's any gap in law here is just simply not credible. And so some who are, I think, holding their noses are doing so on the theory that you continue to have hopeful influence on what the other camp's intent is to keep expanding this treaty through subsequent protocols and so on. And I think you also have some delegations, and it's possible Canada may be in this boat to some degree, which has where the delegation has been, you know, vocal in negotiations, and they perceive a diplomatic cost of not joining. You know, I think ultimately what's an important one is the approach that the United States took at the time. It was the President Biden's administration where, you know, we know they were weighing in the balance the diplomatic cost of not signing on. And what they did ultimately in November 2024 was to express enough support to enable the U.S. to further engage in diplomatic negotiations. But they made explicitly clear that a lot turns on whether states take necessary steps to show that the convention will not be applied in the way that we fear, and said explicitly that the U.S. is unlikely to sign or ratify unless and until we see implementation of meaningful human rights and other legal protections by the convention's signatories. And a few moments ago, I talked about how in the year since the treaty opened for signature, I unfortunately am not at all, I don't think we're not at all seeing that. But the approach showed that the states need not sign to have that influence on future negotiations.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And, you know, speaking of, you know, what, if anything's changed since the signing, and you just suggested not much, if anything, Canada was a no-show in Hanoi when this was signed. So Canada also declined to sign. And at the time, Canadian government said that the treaty's success rested on states' commitment to fully apply human rights safeguards. It sounds somewhat similar to what you just described coming out of the Biden administration. But 9 months later, it just goes ahead on just one summer day, puts out a release and says it's signed. You know, what's your read on what, if anything, changed or why now from a Canadian government perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's a important question. I think I would answer it this way because we don't have a lot of clarity on this. You know, Prime Minister Carney's speech in Davos has been the subject of a lot of discussion. In particular, his reference to the rupture in rules-based order. And I think Canada has had a long-standing role as a leader on human rights frameworks and their importance. And I think one of the biggest problems that I would raise with his speech in discussion of the role of rules-based order was the sort of sleight of hand that happened mid-speech that sort of repositioned treaty frameworks like human rights frameworks as something that superpowers impose on middle powers, and that's something we should no longer be disillusioned by. Multilateral human rights frameworks, in my view, are middle power tools, not superpower tools, and they make middle power stronger united. There's no question that superpowers violate those frameworks, but and they will do so with impunity too often. But that doesn't justify, I think, walking away from, you know, rules-based order in the human rights arena. And I don't think it's a great coincidence that we're now seeing signed in this month in Canada a mutual assistance treaty on electronic evidence with countries that, you know, like China and Saudi Arabia, that Canada has not been in those frameworks with before, right on the heels of a significant shift in Ottawa towards trade and diplomatic relations with those countries. China is one of multiple countries that has a long history of tying commercial relationships to its to that country's support of their diplomatic efforts on a state-centric vision of the internet. We heard the joint statement from Prime Minister Carney and President Xi after their meeting that the two sides had committed to strengthening law enforcement cooperation, including on cyber fraud in particular. The statement came at a time when we know that human rights organizations are sounding the alarm about a sweeping new cybercrime law that China is passing this year. Unsurprising, not long after China signed on to this convention. And Human Rights Watch warned that it will undermine online anonymity, chill free speech, and the bill has extraterritorial reach. This, we also saw an MOU put in place between the RCMP and China's Ministry of Public Security. But I think it, you know, there will be and there are debates happening about whether the shift in, you know, diplomatic relations, if you could put it that way, is a good thing. But I think what should be overwhelmingly clear is that crime policy should not be treated as a chip in a trade deal. These frameworks are too high stakes. They're devastating, if going wrong, to the most significant interests that human rights frameworks protect: threats to life, threats of torture, imprisonment of dissidents, and so on. So I think that, you know, Canada has more recently been more open about its threats of that it faces of transnational repression. But we don't have a good track record on this. You know, it was an assessment in 2022 from Freedom House that we have too often cooperated with governments and given them access to people living in this country in exchange for short-term policy benefits. And I'm troubled by the possibility that we're regressing back to that time.
Yeah, no, I mean, it. I mean, that description, I think it's a bit chilling. It strikes me that on this podcast and in the digital policy world, there's been, of course, a lot of talk about that same kind of trade-offs in the trade realm, but primarily with the United States, where we've seen, you know, backing down on things like digital services tax, the shift on the Online Streaming Act, and a very strong direct correlation between U.S. trade-related issues and some of those policies. You're opening it essentially a whole nother realm here, saying that it's not just the United States where we see some of these trade-offs taking place, and in fact that it may be relationship with China and some other countries that where we're seeing this happen, and the consequences there in some ways I think are even more severe, as you've pointed out. You know, before we go, there's a few things that I want to focus on the domestic side here in Canada, and starting with lawful access. You mentioned Bill C-22 a little bit earlier. You've said that some of the criticisms that came up in that letter that you signed along with many other groups were only amplified by the lawful access bill. Can you explain a little bit how the domestic powers in Bill C-22, which, just to remind listeners, has now passed the House and will head to the Senate or be part of hearings at the Senate in the fall, how do the domestic powers in that bill and the international sharing obligations in this treaty reinforce each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the, you know, human rights experts were warning with respect to the UN Cybercrime Convention, that its provisions, you know, I mentioned Article 8, 28.4 about surveillance capability demands that could be made. They also point to how countries with unlawfully overbroad and indiscriminate metadata retention laws can not only exploit the convention, but be the subject of demands under the convention. And the unfortunate irony is that if Bill C-22 passes, Canada will be one of those threats. And I don't think that they really, you know, when those criticisms were made, we're not talking about countries like Canada, but nevertheless, here we are. Governments with repressive justice systems will be able to point to Canada's Bill C-22 as a model to emulate. Which is a big problem, because even if you were to accept sort of facial assertions that, or I should say verbal assertions that the government doesn't intend to threaten service providers like Signal, that's not what the legislation says and does. Signal itself testified that Part 2 is so broad and secretive that it is itself contrary to human rights law, and I completely agree with that assessment. Textually, providers like Signal are threatened by forced metadata retention, and the government has really refused to listen to the warning on this. It said it would fix encryption, and of course, we find out after the study is over and the text is published that the amendment they had in mind is so narrow that I think it really only shows the government's interest in moving ahead with the power to bypass encryption. It ignored recommendations from Signal, the privacy commissioner, that an amendment was needed to explicitly say it orders can't weaken, bypass, or degrade encryption. That was ignored. There was a warning that metadata retention is too broad and it should be limited to telecom only at minimum. That was also ignored. So this is a concern, obviously, for Canada and elsewhere. You know, when we have troves of data available and stored in Canada, they become available through assistance requests under the UN Convention. And just to give you an example of what we're really talking about here, there's one organization that many in Canada are lucky enough to not know, which is based in Canada. It's called Siphon, and it's an anti-censorship tool that, you know, many may not use it here, of course, but I've seen, you know, CBC reporting where it was used by as many as 15 million Iranians to get access to information in the context of internet lockdowns. So it's a Canadian app in the fight for internet freedom in Iran and around the world. The Iranian government has made clear that it treats the use of these types of anti-censorship tools like VPNs as a crime. And, you know, now that we have Iran as a signatory in Bill C-22, this is a threat to people who depend on tools like Siphon and Signal as a lifeline to democratic speech and protest.
Wow. A real world example how millions can be directly affected by this. And the company that we're keeping and the model we're providing, I think, is going to lead many to give their head a shake in terms of where this is headed. I guess two last questions, starting first with just putting forward the caveat to be clear for anyone listening that signature is not the same as ratification. And so there is still another decision that would lie ahead, although signing provides a signal, so to speak, that Canada doesn't intend to move ahead. You don't sign. Otherwise, this treaty needs 40 ratifications to enter into force. We're still some way away from that. What are some of the pressure points between now and then, whether it might be reservations to the treaty, implementing legislation, committee study? What are some of the kinds of things that you could think of that might happen to sort of help ensure that either Canada doesn't take that next step, or if they do, that there are some safeguards in place?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably clear by now that, you know, it's my respectful view that signature was a mistake. And I really think at this point, it shouldn't go any further than it's already gone. They should just period not ratify this treaty. I think that the Canadian delegation has done important work in its negotiations of the treaty itself. And I think they should continue to have as much influence as they can on the upcoming processes. They didn't need to be a signatory to do that. Nevertheless, here we are. The Canadian government, I mean, when I hear international colleagues speaking about this, it's almost impossible not to think about just how fundamentally the international landscape has shifted with the change of the US administration in terms of the funding available for a lot of the digital rights work that has been happening either within the UN or on the outside of it. A lot of that work has been fundamentally decimated by the US's abandonment of its considerable role that it's had in terms of a multilateral supporter of a lot of that human rights work that was happening. And so I think we need to be eyes wide open about how great the risks are, not only just textually, but in terms of implementation. The Canadian government can and should be pushing for funding for the High Commissioner for Human Rights to build its capacity to mitigate some of these human rights risks. But ultimately, I mean, I think Canada plainly doesn't need this treaty to fight cybercrime. It shouldn't ratify it, period. And I think many have pointed out that states have even more leverage if they've not already bought into the whole deal. And I find that argument the most compelling.
Okay. I mean, in some ways that really is where we ought to close here, but, I do want to at least note that, you know, you focused quite a lot, and we had it on an earlier podcast, on the Budapest Convention, the second additional protocol. Government consulted on that. We haven't seen, to my knowledge, any real consultation here at all. This really just came out of nowhere. So, you know, if there is some sort of consultation, what are some of the kinds of things that you think need to be put on the table? I mean, you made it clear you don't think that we ought to be ratifying. Is there any world in which we can responsibly ratify, or this is an agreement that was tainted and problematic really from its inception? It hasn't improved, and this is something that Canada ultimately shouldn't really be part of.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, to your point about consultation, I think that should have been happening even before signature, and it should happen now to the extent that there's any consideration of ratification. You know, as far to my knowledge, none of the signatories of the what was essentially an 8-page brief that was submitted to the Department of Justice and Global Affairs and at the end of 2024, I don't believe anyone reached out to dialogue in respect of the concerns, significant concerns raised in that document. I think you know, your question speaks to I think a difficult situation that we're really seeing in a more general way in Canada in terms of crime and tech policy. I think that you have this problem that, you know, you hear a framing of how Canada needs more lawful access, crime fighting tools, and really we have successive expansions of those powers. This is now the second controversial surveillance treaty that Canada has signed in recent years. While protective frameworks, you know, like the Convention 108 Plus, ignored for I don't know what reason. Same with how you have criminal code surveillance powers being expanded without contemporaneous preceding protections being put in place in PIPEDA or Privacy Act. We don't have legislation prohibiting the most dangerous uses of AI in policing. We don't have legislation. You know, we could have an entire hour more talking about the gaps in our law applicable to spyware itself. And since I wrote that piece in Lawfare, I've reported on how Ontario itself has a growing ecosystem that appears to be buying what is a very dangerous technology. And I think the other area that I would really emphasize in terms of how we're approaching policymaking is to really think about crime policy from a more evidence-based standpoint. You know, we don't have data on the volume of state requests for legal assistance that we're getting annually. We don't have data on the staffing levels that Canada is giving to mutual assistance frameworks that are the only stopgap, as far as I can tell. When we put forward legislation like C-22, you know, we have questions to law enforcement about what do we need. But, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail, as the saying goes. And law enforcement is not an expert. They're not experts in crime prevention. They're experts in detecting, investigating crime. The work of criminologists is what helps us understand contextually and systemically how to prevent crime. And, you know, we don't have, you know, evidence coming forward. You know, these are the surveillance tools in country X that we would like to emulate. They're doing it. We should do it too, but we don't have the follow through with, well, once they put those laws in place, the crime rates went down. That's not what the data shows, unfortunately. So I think that, you know, there have been studies about how Canada can do better to fight cybercrime. And they really talk about this as a resource game, which is something I've seen in my work in the justice system. We don't need surveillance tools. We need dedicated people with experience, time, and follow through to corral and push the cases through. And so I think what I would really end with is a bit of a perhaps detour, because it hasn't come up in our conversation so far, which is, RCMP reform. It's the glaring absentee, in my view, in the policy debates that are happening. Resistance within the RCMP itself is, understood to be what is stymieing the much needed reform to make the service more capable of being a specialized tool to more effectively combat some of the complex types of cybercrime that this policy is supposedly targeting. And I am told we have a pragmatic government in power. And so I believe that it's the time to have a pragmatic solution such as that put forward.
Okay. All right. Well, another issue to put on the list that would make a difference, that cutting across a number of different issues. You know, you mentioned the need to invest more time, certainly, in sort of better understanding the data, better understanding these issues. You're one of the few people that really have devoted significant amounts of time to certainly these treaties and their implications. You were there early on when few were paying attention. Few are still paying attention, I fear, even as the government goes ahead and signs it. But thank you for the work and for coming on the podcast to help ensure that more people are aware, and perhaps we can see a bit of a course correction for what remains just a really head-scratching decision by the Canadian government.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbytes@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBytesPod or follow Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.